This evening, I can't promise you any music as we had last week. It may be grunts, snores, and people's heads dropping. And I hope that's more related to the theme than the content of what I'm saying, or lulling you into a deep sleep. As Julie mentioned my two hats, I could see a couple of people chuckling because they are students at the University of Surrey. See both hats being worn, and I don't know if they've ever speculated I've got two heads to wear two hats. I hope not. So yes, I'm going to be thinking about waking and sleeping and the night as picked up in the Psalms. I was very touched last week as Catherine spoke about the Psalms in connection with the death of her father, and she set me thinking last week, and it was something I wanted to share today, how after my grandmother died when I was 14, my grandfather was very keen to go to Iona, and he didn't want to go on his own, and so he took me, and it was a wonderful grandfather-grandson bonding session as we got on the train from Rugby up to Glasgow, sat with a drunken oil rig worker and who was pouring out his life story. We eventually got to Oban, and then from there went across to Mull and then to Iona and had the most wonderful time. But in a way, the thing that really struck me most was this new experience of Compline, something I'd never been aware of before and then seemed to hear a lot about ever since. And what really struck me is we were in the cathedral that serves the Diocese of Argyll and the Isles was some of those phrases that, of course, now I know were from the Psalms. Keep me as the apple of your eye. Come, you servants of the Lord, bless the Lord. I will lie down in peace. I was also very moved, and perhaps Lent is a good time to reflect on this, on that responsory, into your hands, O Lord, I commend my spirit. Words of Jesus on the cross, perhaps the most beautiful words we could say as our dying words, and perhaps words we should say, albeit not from the Psalms, as we rest our heads on our pillows and go to sleep. Into your hands, Lord, I commend my spirit. And I want to commend, I hope, my words to the Lord, that he'll bless them and transform them so that they really speak to you tonight, and so that our conversation after I've spoken can continue. I think it's been stated in each of the talks so far, and will be again, that the Psalms really touch on all aspects of human experience and the breadth of the human condition. There'll be Psalms you'll be able to think about very quickly that touch the great heights of praise and glorification, and also touch the lows of desolation. And my claim, if you like, tonight is that the Psalms also take reference of that one third of our life that we usually pay very little attention to, and that third of our lives being when we're asleep. Julie mentioned that this has been a consuming passion for me, thinking about sleep in relation to theology and spirituality for the last couple, nearly 3 years now, and something that in my, I'm saying extended ministerial development leave because Hazel's sitting in the front row, director of ministry. Let's pretend she's not here just for a moment, say my sabbatical, then you have an idea of what I'm actually talking about. And I want to suggest tonight, as I think further about sleep, and I hadn't thought about the Psalms directly in connection of sleep, so this is fresh work. So those of you who've heard me speak about sleep before, don't worry, it's not going to be a rehash of my greatest hits, or one-hit wonders, you might say. But I want to suggest that the Psalms take us into all sorts of areas, meditating on God in the night, peacefulness, vigilance, and its flip side, insomnia, sleep and mortality, sleep and God's protection, sleep and God's watchfulness, sleep and anguish, sleep and praise at night. I hope by the end of when I finish speaking that I'll have touched all those themes in one way or another. And as Julie said, I'm intending to do, I want to see if we can draw all that together in the office of Compline, night prayer. And as Catherine reminded us last week, the meat, if you like, between the two bits of bread of every office, morning prayer, evening prayer, are the Psalms. And traditionally, as a minor office, I think I'm right in saying, the candles on the altar are not lit for Compline. So perhaps you can picture a very, very dark place where the Psalms of Compline are being sung. And it may just be, this is me speculating, that the same three psalms traditionally are used at Compline each time, Psalms 4, 91 and 133. Night after night, they're easily committed to memory. You don't then have to be looking up different psalm texts in the book. And if it's dark, that's really rather helpful. So just as a little bit more background, my interest in sleep was awakened, boom, boom, by participating in a multidisciplinary seminar at the University of Surrey in May 2013. I often say, as a non-scientist, I'm frequently amazed and astonished by the work of scientists, and I think they're wonderful, although well outside my academic comfort zone. And so it seemed to me it was worth going along to hear these different disciplines, people from different disciplines, talking about sleep in their discipline. So I had an idea what biologists might talk about when they talked about sleep. And they didn't disappoint. They described the features of sleep in animals, the rhythms, the hormones, the chemical things, this gets very technical, chemical things going on in our bodies that induce sleep in us. Biologists also speculating about the evolutionary reasons for sleep. And actually, they haven't come to a settled opinion on that, interestingly. I assumed that a psychologist talking about sleep was going to be talking about weird dreams and relationships with mothers or fathers or those sort of Freudian type things. Actually, there was a lot more talking about, in the phraseology, good sleep hygiene and how that might have an impact, particularly in terms of mental health and mental well-being. Does poor sleep lead to poor mental health, or is it a feature of poor mental health to have poor sleep or too much sleep? And there's a whole body of literature that explores that further. I must admit, I didn't know what sociology would want to say about sleep. But there are all sorts of very fascinating insights about human society organising around sleep, how we privatise sleep in affluent societies when we have our own bedrooms dedicated to sleep. Early modern society, everyone would have slept in the same place and presumably going back a long way, all in the same cave. And also sociologists, and I think this touches a really important thing in terms of discipleship in human living today, the 24/7 nature of society, globalized, people having to be at work at 5 o'clock in the morning because the markets in Japan are closing, and how we view sleep and rest and the night in that sort of situation. So sleep becomes politicized. What are the consequences, both social and health-wise, on shift workers, for example? Another contribution to the seminar was from the discipline of English literature. And I'm sure you're far better read than me, but Shakespeare, Milton, Thackeray and Dickens all have quite interesting treatments of sleep. So I was left with the question, what might theology say to sleep? And our question tonight is, what's it got to do with the Psalms? It seems to me that we spend a lot of time as Christians thinking about the two-thirds of our lives when we're wide awake, when we're consciously interacting with God, usually getting in God's way in the process and really not listening carefully. But what of that third of our life? What's going on when our eyelids shut and we're not aware of what God is doing for us, and yet we might have a conviction that God is watching over us? Is it really true? Do we really believe that God is watching over us, whatever we might be doing? Well, Psalm 121 suggests, "Behold, he who watches over Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep." You might be asleep, but God isn't. God is watching over you. Sleep also becomes a bit of an antidote to the notion that sharing in the life of God can only be done when we're conscious and active and wakeful and alert. Sometimes, actually, we need to rest in God, rely on God's grace. One of the concepts, if you like, that I've thought a lot about is one I've made up a word. Some of you may have heard this word that I've made up, and the word is theosomnia. Theo, as in theos, God, somnia, sleep. When I say theosomnia and talk about theosomniacs, that's an even better word, you should see what spell checks try and do to these words that you make up. By this I mean sleep that is hallowed, intentionally offered to God. I think the word theosomnia is attempting to capture that beautiful and mystical verse in the Song of Songs. I sleep, yet my heart wakes. This is the sleep of the disciple, the sleep seen in Jesus as he slept on the boat on the Sea of Galilee during the storm. This is the sleep of radical openness to God the Father, since it is a Christ-like posture that we adopt. Theosomnia acknowledges that sleep is a time when God can work deep within the self, when our egos are not pushing God out of the picture. And I want to suggest tonight particularly that Compline is a theosomniac practice. Never thought you'd hear that phrase ever, did you? Compline is a theosomniac practice. So let's now turn to the bulk of what we're thinking about tonight and praying the Psalms and thinking about Psalms to open up those themes around sleep, the night, and the darkness. So the first thing I want to think a little bit about is meditating in the night. Our awareness of God, according to the Psalms, is not restricted simply to when we are awake and when it's light and bright. The whole of our life, both waking and sleeping, is under the loving gaze of God, and we are to respond in trust to that love. It's in that trusting context that we say with the psalmist in Psalm 4, I lie down to sleep. As we say, I lie down to sleep, we offer ourselves as God's servant, resting in God. The Psalms give us a sense of what St. Paul perhaps is talking about in 1 Thessalonians, as he says, pray without ceasing. The very first psalm says, their delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law they meditate day and night. And Psalm 77, I commune with my heart in the night, I meditate and search my spirit. The darkness and the night, especially when sleep is absent, is an acute time of being awake. And we know that trauma and anxiety can disrupt our sleep. Psalm 77 again says, in the day of my trouble I seek the Lord. In the night my hand is stretched out with wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. I think of God and I moan. I meditate and my spirit faints. There's that theme of insomnia coming in, but also connected with vigilance and being awake to meditate on God. I don't know if you've ever had the experience like me of being in bed and thinking, while I'm lying down, I'll just pray. And then the next morning you wake up and think, gosh, I fell asleep while I was praying. It's interesting how different writers handle this. Some say that's good. That means God is trying to give you the gift of sleep and answering your prayer by giving you sleep. Others are a bit stricter and saying, well, hang on, you were meant to be praying. What are you doing falling asleep? Perhaps it's a bit of a cop-out to say that's what God wanted me to do. But isn't it interesting that for us to fall asleep, we have to put ourselves in a particular posture? Just as if we're going to pray, we need to put ourselves in a posture, physical and spiritual. If I'm going to be standing up, it's almost certain that this posture is not going to allow sleep to fall upon me. But if I was to lie down, perhaps not quite on this floor, but the gentle heat rising up from the underfloor heating and with my head on a hassock, I've got more chance of being open to sleep and it falling upon me. So it is with prayer. If I adopt a posture, be that kneeling or standing with my arms outstretched or sitting with my hands open, or a posture that induces prayer in me, prayer is more likely to fall upon me, or at least well up within me. So sleeping and praying can be very connected, and this meditating on God in the night. The Psalms continue to insist, I bless the Lord who gives me counsel. In the night he also instructs my heart, Psalm 16. And then in Psalm 63, the writer, who is on his bed, says, when I think of you on my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night, for you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I sing for joy. Beautiful image, actually, of God watching over us. In the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. That sounds to me like a prayer just before sleep is about to fall on someone. I wonder, in your own practice of hallowing your sleep, are those words of Psalm 63 ones that you could make your own, or perhaps you use other words with that spirit? I sing for joy. It's very interesting reading a book called, I've forgotten what it's called. Oh yes, Brief History of the Night by Roger Erkich. And he describes all sorts of nocturnal things which are really rather exciting and a bit salacious and fun. But one of the things he talks about is pre-modern patterns of sleep. And there seems to be pretty good evidence for this, that unlike now, when we think a good night's sleep is a good solid chunk of 7 or 8 hours from a reasonable time in the evening to a good time in the morning, and we know that through EEG with monitoring of electrical patterns going on in our minds, we know that we move through different phases of sleep, some lighter, some deeper. We have rapid eye movement sleep, which seems to be the most generative phase of our sleep. But it seems pretty well attested now that in pre-modern times, people would sleep and then wake, and then go back to sleep and possibly wake again. And it would seem that the Psalms reflect this as they speak of meditating on God in the watches of the night. Basically, Roger Erkich suggests, especially on moonlit nights, people would get up and go and visit the neighbours, or go for a walk, or think about, do they want more children, talk and chat. And of course, the pious, what would they do? Psalm 119, I remember your name in the night, O Lord, and keep your law. My eyes are awake before each watch of the night, that I may meditate on your promise. Meditating through the night and hallowing each of the watches of the night. It's very hard to unravel sleep and the night, but perhaps that concept of theosomnia helps us understand the night as hallowed by God, the night having a purpose according to the Psalms, in which we may meditate upon God. That moves us on then to sleep and peace in the Psalms. I've already mentioned that key text from the Song of Songs, which of course isn't in the Psalms. I sleep, yet my heart wakes. The mystical and contemplative writers, particularly in the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, are deeply intrigued by that verse. But it's echoed, I think, in the Psalms. Psalm 3, verse 5, I lie down and sleep. I wake again, for the Lord sustains me. Part of what's going on there is that the gift of sleep is given to the individual, and the peace that comes from that. It means that we can be at one with God, even when we're asleep. There's no further conscious effort to find peace, other than to surrender to it in our sleep. As I've already mentioned, Psalm 4, I will lie down and sleep in peace. For you alone, O Lord, make me lie down in safety. But what about those times when we can't sleep in peace? There are lots of occasions when people have said to me, oh, it's all very well talking about sleep all the time and sleep and prayer. I don't sleep very well, or I have a haunted sleep and dreadful dreams, or I'm thinking so much about the next day, or as I've got older in life, I used to be able to sleep so well, but now I can't. And this brings us back to what I was hinting at, of the themes of insomnia in the Psalms. But there's a French philosopher, Jean-Luc Nancy, who says that insomnia is a form of what he calls radical vigilance. Well, that may be so for a philosopher, but it slightly lacks the pastoral touch, doesn't it? To say to someone, well, I know you can't sleep, but think of it as radical vigilance. I don't know how much ice that will cut. But I think there is a sense, if we're unable to sleep, what might we be watching out for? What is it that we lie awake and consider and contemplate? Because as we lie awake at night, it is true that we hear things more sharply, and certainly I've got childhood memories of being awake at night and seeing patterns in my curtains that suddenly look very, very frightening. That being awake at night is a frightening time. Insomnia is a frightening thing, and the Psalms, it seems to me, capture and name the brutality of insomnia, especially that brought on by distress or trauma or illness or anxiety. So I'm going to quote four of them now. Psalm 6, I am weary with my moaning. Every night I flood my bed with tears. Psalm 22, O my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but find no rest. Psalm 42, my tears have been my food day and night, while people say to me continually, where is your God? Psalm 88, O Lord, God of my salvation, when at night I cry out in your presence, let your prayer come before me, incline your ear to my cry. This is a different way of perceiving when we lie awake at night, when we're desperate to sleep, and sleep's one of those things, the more we want it, the more elusive it seems to be. Perhaps that's a metaphor for other aspects of our Christian lives, and really what we need to try to do is to surrender to it and not grasp after it. There's another psalm, Psalm 132, which perhaps opens up in the spirit of Jean-Luc Nancy, this sense of vigilance. Because if you think about vigilance, and especially vigils in Christian practice, going through the night, or those night offices of religious communities waking at 2:30 at night, what on earth are they doing? Actually, speak to them and they say, we're praying for those who cannot sleep, who suffer insomnia. We're praying for shift workers. We're praying for the A&E department at our local hospital. We're praying for people who are depressed at their lowest ebb. And we know those who contemplate suicide often do it in the watches of the night. We're praying for mothers delivering babies. So many babies, not all of course, born during the night. The one who is vigilant, the lookout, the watcher, is the one who has to deprive him or herself of sleep in order that others may sleep. That's what vigilance is about, I think. So Psalm 132, I will not enter my house or get into my bed. I will not give sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids until I find a place for the Lord, a dwelling for the Mighty One of Jacob. That echoes, it seems to me, as we get towards Holy Week, Jesus' words to his disciples in Gethsemane. Could you not just stay awake for 1 hour? If you've been at Evensong this evening, the reading ended, and what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake. There may then be a distinction between insomnia and vigilance reflected in the Psalms. There are different sleep patterns when we're young and when we're old. The Psalms don't really seem to suggest much about that, but they certainly address that human experience of insomnia, but also help to turn it to say, look out for God and surrender to his gift of sleep. One way we can respond to this sense of a lack of vigilance is to think that God is vigilant. God is watchful and looks over us. The Psalms certainly reflect this. They give us theological support for a sense that sleep is part of the condition of being a creature, somebody made by God. But that God doesn't sleep. God is ever watchful because God is not a creature. God is no thing, no created thing, but is the creator. God does not sleep, according to the Psalms. Of course, you're saying, hang on, Jesus is God, isn't he? And he fell asleep. I think that's another thing we might tackle another time, or perhaps later, about the incarnation, because clearly Jesus, God, slept on the boat in the storm on the Sea of Galilee. But we have this deep sense coming out of the Psalms that waking or sleeping, we are wrapped in the loving gaze of our Maker, under the shadow of God's wings, we might say. So we have the verse, the sort of test verse for that. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. He who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. I've often speculated that Psalm 139, the one that begins, O Lord, you have searched me out and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You discern my thoughts from afar. I've often felt that's a psalm of someone who's reflecting back on the past day and looking towards the watchfulness of God in the night. That psalm continues, if I say, surely darkness will cover me and the light around me become night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for the darkness is as light to you. What then, though, of the ultimate darkness, the darkness of death? Sleep connects a lot to mortality. I've had fascinating conversations with some of my colleagues of other faiths at the university on this question. My Muslim colleague was very clear that in Islam, if I've understood him correctly, it's thought that when you fall asleep at night, you have died a little death. And it's only if Allah, God, wills to wake you in the morning that you will wake up. My Jewish colleague said, yes, the rabbis have long debated this question, again, if I'm representing him correctly. And I think there was something around, you're 5/9 dead, but you're not quite dead. And when I first heard that, I thought, are you on about? You're either dead or you're not, aren't you? And actually, it sort of makes sense. We will say of someone fast asleep, they're dead to the world. Is that 5/9 or 6/9? I don't know, it doesn't matter. But sleep becomes a metaphor for death as well. Jean-Luc Nancy's book, which I just couldn't find on my bookshelf, so I couldn't check out the detail of this, in English is called The Fall of Sleep, but in French it's something like Le Tombe de Dormir. French scholars, please pick me up on this later on. Almost meaning the tomb of sleep. So he's playing very much on the sleep and mortality, the idea that we're entombed in sleep while we sleep. And clearly sleep is used as a metaphor for death and deployed by St. Paul in 1 Corinthians. There are problems with that. If we hear those stories of perhaps somebody saying to a little child, don't worry about granny, she's just fallen asleep. There are actually problems with that because granny really hasn't fallen asleep because she's not going to wake up and you're not going to see granny again. And it might just be suggesting to a child who's told that that sleep's really quite dangerous because you might not wake up in the morning and become a point of fear. But for a Christian understanding of sleep in relation to death, it does make sense if we think that sleep, as far as our physical and spiritual well-being goes, sleep is benign, it's not harmful, it's not going to hurt us, and sleep is a time from which we will wake. St. Paul argues this is the same with the resurrection of the body. We will die, we really will be dead, but because of the death and resurrection of Christ, death has lost its sting, and in that sense, death is benign. And one day Christ will call the dead from their tombs. And so death is something from which we will wake. But we don't have that understanding of resurrection, I'd suggest, in early Hebrew thought, from where the Psalms are coming, although you might find hints and exceptions to that. So we have a Christian tendency, which I think is quite legitimate, that we interpret the Psalms in the light of the resurrection of Jesus. But we often forget that the psalmist didn't share our post-resurrection take on things. So when the psalmist is speaking of the sleep of death, it's not a metaphor that speaks of resurrection, rather it's talking about death itself and really annihilation. So we get in Psalm 13, consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep the sleep of death. And my enemy will say, I have prevailed. My foes will rejoice because I am shaken. That's one of the reasons, perhaps, why sometimes people feel the Psalms are just a bit too Old Testament and not Christian enough for them. And I suspect we'll hear a bit more about that in the coming 2 weeks. But there are hints of resurrection in, for example, Psalm 22, so familiar as the psalm Jesus alludes to from the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? There is a verse later on in that. To God indeed shall all who sleep in the earth bow down. Before him shall bow down all who go down to the dust. And I shall live for him. Sense that sleep, the sleep of death, isn't total annihilation, that actually even the dead can praise God. So what of waking? Psalms don't just deal with the night and falling asleep, but also the act of waking from sleep, the time when sleep just falls away from you rather than falls on you. We have those wonderful, bright, cornflake-type verses. Awake, my soul, awake, O harp and lyre, I will awake the dawn. Anticipation of the gift of the new day. And there's a psalm of reassurance in the words of Psalm 30, that uses the typical Hebrew couplet. For his anger is but for a moment, his favour is for a lifetime. Weeping may linger for the night, but joy comes in the morning. There's an expectant feel to waking in the Psalms. Interestingly, though, there's more reference not to human waking in the Psalms, but to God waking. You can say, hang on. Psalm 121, excuse me, canon, you said God never falls asleep. But there are certainly times when we feel God has fallen asleep. There are times which the Psalms articulate when we feel that God has dozed off on his watch. Somehow God is failing to watch over his people and their situation. The Psalms I'm going to quote in a moment, I could well imagine on the lips of a Christian in Aleppo tonight, or on the lips of a Jew in Poland in 1942, or the survivor of trauma or abuse, one who just feels abandoned by God. Perhaps even these are the words that the disciples said to Jesus on the boat in the storm. Psalm 35, wake up, bestir yourself for my defense, for my cause, my God and my Lord. Or, rise up, why do you sleep, O Lord? Awake, do not cast us off forever. The Coverdale translation of that verse, I think, is even more powerful. Up, Lord, why sleepest thou? Awake, and be not absent from us forever. That desperate plea that God actually is awake and is watching over us. And yet, Psalm 78 gives us an almost comical image of God waking up. And this is Coverdale's version again. So the Lord awaked as one out of sleep, like a giant refreshed with wine. And going back to Catherine last week, when the choir sing that, they just sing it in such a wonderful, powerful way, and the chant just seems to add to it. So, whoa, lots of themes all coming out of the Psalms. And as I was suggesting at the beginning, I think those strands, if you like, start to get knitted together in the office of Compline. As we prepare as theosomniacs to go to sleep, as we offer to God a sense of meditating on God during the night, praying for the gift of sleep, praying for peace, mindful that we want to be vigilant but that we may be deprived of sleep. We want God watching over us. We associate sleep and mortality, and that it may be God who needs waking up from time to time. Compline is a bit like Sabbath, completion and rest. The Sabbath, of course, is one day in seven. I think sleep is a bit like a Sabbath given to us at the end of every day, or as Jews would say in Hebrew thought, the beginning of every day. For them, the night starts, as the creation is described, there was evening and there was morning, the first day. Psalm 4 again, I will lie down and sleep in peace. No wonder that psalm's used at Compline. It prepares us for the long hours of the night. It prepares us for the coming of the day. If Sabbath is about resting and renewal and refreshment, so is sleep. And this is where we have Psalm 127. It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives sleep to his beloved. And Compline introduces two more themes, and I'm about to draw to a close, so don't panic. The theme of protection at night, as we'll hear sung in the office hymn for Compline tonight. From all ill dreams defend our eyes, from nightly fears and fantasies. Tread underfoot our ghostly foe, that no pollution we may know. Psalm 42 again seems to pick this up. By day the Lord commands his steadfast love, and at night his song is with me, a prayer to the God of my life. And more obviously, Psalm 91, another of the traditional Psalms of Compline. You will not fear the terror of the night or the arrow that flies by day. Terrors of the night can be many and various, from the night terror of a child's dream to the fear of violence or violation at night. Part of our hallowing of our sleep is asking God to watch over us and indeed to protect us during the silent hours of the night. And there's one last theme, and that is praise at night as the day is completed. And this is captured beautifully in Psalm 134, the other traditional psalm of Compline. Come, bless the Lord, all you servants of the Lord, who stand by night in the house of the Lord. Lift up your hands to the holy place and bless the Lord. Compline enables us to remove that psalm from its original context, which probably is the Temple of Jerusalem or a house of prayer, and it enables us to place it too into the temple of our own place of rest. Have you ever thought of your bed as a temple? So our theme is praying the Psalms, and what I hope I've been doing this evening is encouraging reflection on the Psalms as they pertain to the night and to our sleeping and our waking. I hope that I've given some tools for you to think about your own sleep patterns, perhaps your own practices around going to bed and going to sleep. I wanted to weave that together into the office of Compline that will be sung with and for us shortly. And I want to commend to you the way of Theosomnia, that you may be Theosomniacs, offering sleep committed to and hallowed by God. Do sleep well.